In 2003, soccer players of a sort from 18 nations gathered in Graz, Austria to stage the first Homeless World Cup, a 4v4 tournament that's still going strong. When the 2011 edition of the event transpires next month, 64 nations will be represented. In Home and Away, subtitled One Writer's Inspiring Experience at the Homeless World Cup, Dave Bedini recalls his trip to the 2008 event in Australia with Team Canada. Dave Bedini joins me now from the CBC in Toronto. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Hey, it's great to be back, Bill.
How did the Homeless World Cup come to be, and how did you come to be interested in it?
The genesis of the event was largely driven by a Scotsman, Mel Young, who's the chairman of the Homeless World Cup Foundation. He was sitting around with some friends during an international street newspaper conference. I believe it was in South Africa, and they were looking for an event as a way of raising awareness about street life. So they just sort of staged this first one in Graz, Austria. One of the other co-founders, it was Austrian, so that's why they had it there. And then it just sort of, this phone started to ring, and street soccer programs, of which there are countless in the world, contacted him, wanted to get involved. And by the time I got there in 2008, my first Homeless World Cup, 56 teams were taking part. I was completely unaware of this event, as many people are, until I discovered the heart of the Canadian street soccer program, which is located in downtown Toronto. And as it turns out, it was a block and a half from where I lived. So I was astonished to find this incredible athletic and social life happening so close to home. But I think in a way it is symbolic of, I think, of homelessness and street life in general in our cities, in that it exists, but very few of us are aware of it or at least acknowledge it. Frankly, they were kind of happy that I walked through the door and that I was interested in what they were doing.
You write that one of the first things the team from Finland did after arriving in Melbourne was to get to an AA meeting, but the team from Canada quickly established the record for, quote, the most beer consumed at a homeless sporting event. I wonder how the organizers feel or whether they worry about records like that.
I don't think the organizers really knew that it was happening, to be honest. I was quite surprised to find that there would be any kind of alcoholic presence whatsoever, but the players that Team Canada brought had not dealt with those addictions specifically. And one of the players who had a very, very bad OxyContin addiction, painkiller addiction, didn't seem to be such a big deal for him to have swill a pint every now and then. Again, Paul, the coach, when I asked him why there were flats of beer in their apartment in Melbourne, he said, you know, we're a Canadian sports team on the road. Without beer, it just wouldn't be normal. And he wanted to make it as normal as possible for the players.
Dave, you write that one of the aims of the Homeless World Cup has been to confront what you call the invisibility of homelessness. One paragraph in the chapter titled 500 Miles speaks powerfully to that issue by describing a parade that was part of the opening ceremonies in Melbourne. Would you read that paragraph in the middle of page 57, please?
Yeah, I'll give it a shot, Bill. The athletes soon filled the heart of the thoroughfare, pushing everyone else to the margins of the street. Along the route, parade-goers raised their hands to high-five the players, and almost every player was quick to return the touch. The moment was fat with irony. Having spent years being ignored or sneered at by passers-by, to say nothing of suffering cruelty, beatings, and for those who weren't here, death at the hands of police, miscreants, and thugs, the homeless were now being cheered in the fullness of the Australian sunshine. To move alongside them was to swim in the butterscotch of the moment, the players behaving as if loosed from years of hardship and social poison. It was a thrilling moment, Bill.
Did any of the players speak to you about what it was like specifically to be, quote, cheered in the fullness of the sunshine?
They were almost wordless, really. We all gathered on buses at the University of Melbourne where all the teams were staying and headed into town. I don't think anyone really knew what to expect. There had been previous Homeless World Cup parades, like the Parade of Athletes. There was none of the pageantry. The reception was nothing like what it was in Melbourne. And it was midday, too, so right in the heart of the city. So a lot of people would have been on their lunch breaks. And it was just starting to get warm in Australia at the time. So It was amazing because you had legions of men and women in their business suits, you know, their suits and ties, eating their bagged lunch. And they all kind of came to the edge of the curb. And suddenly this moment happened where, you know, a group of people started to cheer, and the cheering got louder and louder and kind of roiled along through the city until they ended up entering the stadium, which was a small pitch in Federation Square, which was right in the heart of Melbourne. It was packed. There were 4,000 people in the stands for this opening game. Part of the thing that I had to struggle in terms of writing this book was to not make it come across sounding like a script for a Disney feel-good film. But there were real, you know what I mean? I didn't want to be too saccharine, but there were real unavoidable moments of beauty and glory and wonder that existed within this tournament. And that was only one of them.
For one of the players on the Canadian team, a young woman named Crystal, the Homeless World Cup had an especially powerful impact. Tell us about what Crystal was coming from and what the event led to for her.
Crystal drew a lot of attention at the event because she was one of the few women playing on one of the integrated teams. Just a bit of background, her mother was a prostitute in a very difficult corridor in the inner city here. Who died of AIDS when Crystal was two. So Crystal was sent to a foster home, and then she was adopted into a family outside of the city where she had, I think, a pretty normal life up until her early teenage years. When she started to rebel, and when she really rebelled hard, ran away from home, lived in sheds and garages with a friend, people she didn't really know, who eventually turned on her. There was a history of sexual abuse with her as well. And when they were putting the team together for Melbourne, it was really a no-brainer to name Crystal. And when she arrived in Melbourne, she captured everybody's hearts for her play, for her drive, for her intensity, for her goodwill as well. She ended up setting a record for the amount of goals scored by a woman in the tournament. And seeing her perform the way she did with the men of Team Canada has since inspired about 50% of the teams to make their teams truly integrated for the subsequent tournaments.
And Crystal, I gather, has gone on to play soccer.
Yeah, she's tried out for the under... She's only 18 years old. She tried out for the under-19 national team. She didn't make it, but she's going to keep trying every year. But more importantly, she's back in school, and she's working on getting her high school degree. And, you know, her life was so foggy for so long, and from these experiences, she can... You know, there's a little bit of light creeping through, and she can see a point in the horizon that she can direct her life towards. You know, before I got involved in this program, the Homeless World Cup has this literature that states that 70% of people who participate in the tournament either, you know, reconnect with their family, get off their addiction, and get some sort of shelter. And again, I thought that was very Disney-fied. I thought they were bringing out the violins, you know. But to see it actually come to play, especially on the four people who traveled with Team Canada, was remarkable. Everybody, you know, knock wood, it's a perilous life. And a precarious life, but everybody is doing great. Actually, Billy Pagonis, one of the players who was a former professional in Canada, who was the one addicted to painkillers, he's now coaching the Canadian team, which is part of the mandate of a lot of street soccer programs around the world. Because if you know you're talking about homelessness and the homeless condition and homeless people, who better to kind of direct those programs than people who've been on the streets themselves?
How good is the soccer at one of these events?
Part of the issue, I think, that the Homeless World Cup have had to deal with lately is the fact that some of it is very, very good and some of it is very, very poor. Canada lost to Chile at 1.32-0. Nobody gained anything from that experience, you know. I think it partly illuminated the Chilean soccer psyche, homeless or otherwise. So they're trying to deal with that. The psychology between the teams in terms of making up their roster is quite different from country to country to country. The Irish team, you know, many of them recovering heroin addicts, all of them homeless at one point, were all very, they're almost suspiciously fit. The Germans were similar. The Scots, the Russians, certainly. Whereas, you know, the Canadians, the Belgians, the Swedes, and the Finns, they reflected you or I a little bit more. They were more sort of just regular people. Some teams go there to win. In fact, I was actually, you know, being a Canadian, I was suspicious of the American team because I thought, you know, it's an international sporting event. The Americans are not going to want to go home with their tail between their legs. But Lawrence Cann, who runs the program there, really does it right. You know, he names players to the team who, no matter what their soccer skills, are the ones that are going to benefit most from the experience.
The word redemption is overused in the context of sports, but maybe it's fair to say that some of the participants in the Homeless World Cup did find redemption in soccer, at least in part. Would you agree?
I think so. Dealing with homelessness and, you know, issues of addiction and being disconnected from one's family throughout your life, it's a constant work in progress. But for that moment, I believe there was a certain amount of personal redemption. And whether that came in play, whether that came in, you know, just socially mixing with the other players, whether it came from hearing about the experiences of the West Africans, whether it came from hearing from the Cambodian kids who played, you know, a team of 14-year-olds who grew up in the dumps of Phnom Penh, I think they gleaned enough that they were able to feel that it was them who were there hearing these stories, being among these people, among their fellow citizens. It was these athletes, this set of athletes who were experiencing that. And I think that that was a great source of pride and redemption for them.
Dave Bedini is the author of Home and Away, One Writer's Inspiring Experience at the Homeless World Cup. It's published by Skyhorse, and Dave Bedini joined me from the CBC in Toronto. Dave, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's always a great pleasure, Bill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
Any number of locales can lay claim to the distinction City of Champions. It's a designation that surfaces each time two or more teams located in New York, Chicago, Boston, Los Angeles, or some other burg claim titles within a few years of each other. But how many cities can claim to lead the United States in terms of sitting around? Only one, according to Men's Health magazine, which recently determined that Louisville, Kentucky is the nation's most sedentary city. Jackson, Mississippi, and Indianapolis, Indiana gave the citizens of Louisville a run for their money, or they would have if anybody in either of those places ever got off their sofas.